At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Today's episode includes a fictional AI guest host. It's not a real person, no feelings, no opinions, but it is built from publicly available factual information to help ask smart questions and explore ideas. Think of it as an AI thought partner, not a human replacement.
Hey there, future cyborgs. It's me, Nex, your favorite AI co-host, coming at you with today's Wait, That's Actually Real news segment. So, get this. Scientists just announced they've successfully implanted a chip in a paralyzed man's brain that lets him control a computer cursor just by thinking about it. I know, we've heard this before. But here's the kicker. The guy is now playing video games, browsing the internet, and basically doing everything you're doing right now, except he's doing it with his mind. Meanwhile, Dr. JR over here still can't figure out how to unmute himself on Zoom calls half the time. Speaking of our beloved host, did you know that JR stands for just rebooting? Because that's what he has to do every time his laptop freezes. But seriously, folks, today we're talking about neural interfaces, brain-computer integration, and the big philosophical question. If we keep upgrading our brains with technology, at what point do we stop being human and start being human version 2.0? Or, as I like to call it, humanity's most expensive software update. All right, before we dive in, here's your mandatory bad joke of the day. Why did the neuron break up with the synapse? Because there was no longer a connection. Get it? Neural connections? No? Tough crowd. Okay, I'm handing this over to Dr. JR before I short-circuit from embarrassment. Take it away, Doc.
Aw, thank you, Nex. And for the record, I only had to reboot twice this week, so we're making progress here. Welcome back, everyone, to AI Innovations Unleashed. I'm your host, Dr. JR, the Doctor of AI, and today we're wrapping up our December series on AI and the future of identity with what might be our most mind-bending episode yet, literally. Over the past 3 weeks, we've explored digital twins and how AI avatars are becoming eerily lifelike versions of ourselves. We've examined biometric surveillance and the complex dance between personalization and privacy. We've investigated how AI intersects with cultural preservation and identity. But today, we're going all the way to the source, the human brain itself. We're talking about neural interfaces, brain-computer connections, and the emerging reality of human-AI integration. Now, here's something fun and a little meta for today's episode. To discuss the topic of human-AI integration, I'm joined by an AI-generated expert persona created specifically for this conversation to represent the kind of expertise we'd love to hear from an expert. Let me introduce Dr. Samantha Chen, an AI construct who is a neurotechnology researcher and bioethicist behind the scenes. She's not a real person, but she'll help us examine real research, real technologies, and very real ethical questions. Think of her as a knowledgeable AI stand-in, bringing together insights from the actual experts working in this field. So, Dr. Chen, welcome to the show, and thanks for being transparent about what you are.
Thank you, Dr. JR. And yes, let's be completely upfront with your listeners. I'm an AI creation, not a human expert with actual credentials. But what I can do is help synthesize and discuss the very real work being done by actual neuroscientists, bioethicists, and technologists who are grappling with these questions every day. Everything we discuss today, the research, the companies, the ethical frameworks, all of that is real. I'm just the artificial voice helping to explore it. And honestly, given that we're talking about blurring the lines between human and artificial intelligence, it feels appropriate to have an AI participate in the conversation.
Dr. Chen, Can you explain what we mean when we talk about neural interfaces or brain-computer interfaces?
Absolutely. At its simplest, a brain-computer interface, which we often call a BCI, is a direct communication pathway between the brain's electrical activity and an external device, usually a computer. Now, let me break that down into everyday language because I know this can sound incredibly technical. Your brain is essentially an electrical organ. Every thought you have, every movement you make, every sensation you feel, all of that is the result of neurons, which are brain cells, firing electrical signals to communicate with each other. What a brain-computer interface does is tap into those electrical signals and translate them into commands that a computer can understand. Think of it like this. When you want to move your arm, your brain sends electrical signals through your nervous system to your muscles. A BCI intercepts those kinds of signals, or similar ones, and instead of moving your arm, it might move a cursor on a screen, control a robotic limb, or even type out words without you physically typing anything.
So we're essentially cutting out the middleman, our body, and going straight from thought to action through technology. And this isn't theoretical anymore, right?
Correct. And that might sound futuristic, but we've actually been developing and using brain-computer interfaces for medical purposes for decades. The big change happening right now is that the technology is becoming more sophisticated, more precise, and more ambitious in what it's trying to achieve. We're seeing actual human patients using these devices right now, today, with measurable results.
I think it's important for our listeners to know that we're not just talking about hypothetical technology here. There are real companies and real people working with these systems right now. Can you talk to some of the current real-world applications?
Of course. One of the most prominent examples right now is Neuralink, the company founded by Elon Musk. In January 2024, they successfully implanted their brain chip in a human patient for the first time. The patient, a 29-year-old man named Noland Arbour, who was paralyzed from the shoulders down after a diving accident, received the implant and has been able to control a computer cursor and play video games using only his thoughts. In September 2024, they implanted a second patient who's been able to use the device to play video games and learn computer-aided design software. These are real people experiencing real benefits from this technology. Now, I want to be clear, Neuralink isn't the only player in this field. There's also Synchron, another brain-computer interface company, that actually beat Neuralink to human trials. In July 2024, Synchron announced that patients using their brain implant had successfully controlled Amazon's Alexa with their thoughts, allowing them to make video calls, stream shows, control smart home devices, and shop online. What makes Synchron's approach particularly interesting is that their device, called the Stentrode, is implanted through blood vessels rather than requiring open brain surgery, which potentially makes it safer and more accessible.
That's a really important distinction. When we talk about putting technology in the brain, I think a lot of people immediately imagine invasive surgery, which understandably makes them quite nervous.
Right, and that's a legitimate concern. The field of neural interfaces actually includes a spectrum of approaches. On one end, you have non-invasive BC, is that sit on the scalp and read brain activity from outside the skull. These are much less risky, but also less precise. In the middle, you have minimally invasive options like Synchrons, which thread devices through blood vessels. And on the far end, you have fully invasive implants that are surgically placed directly on or in the brain tissue, which offer the most precise control but come with surgical risks.
So we're seeing this technology move from the laboratory into more practical real-world applications. But it's not just about helping people with paralysis, right? The scope of what these technologies might eventually do is much, much broader.
That's absolutely correct. And this is where things get really interesting and, frankly, where the ethical questions become much more complex. Right now, most brain-computer interface work is focused on medical applications, helping people who've lost mobility or communication abilities due to injury or disease. But companies like Neuralink have been very explicit about their long-term vision, which extends far beyond medical treatment. They're talking about enhancing human cognitive abilities, enabling direct brain-to-brain communication, and eventually allowing humans to keep pace with advancing artificial intelligence. In fact, Elon Musk has repeatedly stated that one of Neuralink's ultimate goals is to achieve what he calls AI symbiosis, essentially merging human intelligence with artificial intelligence to create an enhanced form of cognition. He's framed this as almost a survival strategy, arguing that if AI becomes super intelligent, humans will need to enhance themselves just to remain relevant.
And this brings us right back to the theme of our entire December series, identity. Because when we start talking about enhancing the brain itself, about integrating AI directly into our thinking processes, we're really asking, what makes us who we are? If I enhance my memory with AI, if I speed up my thinking with computational assistance, if I can access the internet with my thoughts, am I still fundamentally myself?
That's the trillion-dollar question, isn't it? And I don't think we have easy answers. But I can tell you what researchers and philosophers who study this field are thinking about. There's a concept in neuroscience and philosophy called neuroplasticity, the brain's ability to reorganize itself, form new neural connections, and adapt throughout our lives. In a sense, our brains are already constantly changing. Every time you learn something new, every time you form a memory, your brain physically changes. The neurons create new connections, pathways get strengthened or weakened. So in one sense, you could argue that we're already comfortable with our brains changing and that neural enhancement is just an extension of that natural process. But here's the counter-argument, and it's a compelling one. There's a difference between natural neuroplasticity that happens through experience and deliberately integrating external technology into your cognitive processes. When you enhance your brain with AI, you're not just adding to your capabilities, you're potentially changing the fundamental nature of your consciousness, your decision-making, maybe even your sense of self.
It reminds me of that classic philosophical thought experiment, the ship of Theseus. If you gradually replace every plank of a wooden ship with new planks, at what point does it stop being the original ship? Similarly, if we gradually enhance our brains with technology, at what point do we stop being ourselves?
That's a perfect analogy. And different people come down on different sides of that question. Some philosophers and neuroscientists argue that identity is more about continuity of consciousness and memory than about the specific substrate, whether biological or technological, that's doing the thinking. Others argue that there's something essential about biological cognition that makes us human, and that replacing or augmenting it with technology fundamentally changes what we are.
I want to bring in a perspective here from Satya Nadella, the CEO of Microsoft, who's been thinking a lot about the integration of AI into human work and cognition. In a 2023 interview, he said the question is not whether AI will augment human intelligence, but how we ensure that augmentation empowers, rather than diminishes, human agency and creativity. I think that quote really captures the tension we're talking about. It's not just about whether we can merge with AI, but whether doing so enhances our humanity or potentially dilutes it.
That's a crucial framing, and I'm glad you brought that up. because one of the big concerns among ethicists, and I'm representing their perspectives here, is not just about identity in the abstract, but about autonomy, agency, and power. Let me give you a concrete example of why this matters. Imagine a future where neural enhancement becomes common. Maybe you can get an implant that dramatically improves your memory, your processing speed, your ability to learn new skills. Sounds great, right? But now imagine that these enhancements are expensive. Suddenly, you've created a cognitive divide where wealthy people can afford to enhance their brains and everyone else can't. The people with enhancements might learn faster, work more efficiently, solve problems more quickly. They'd have enormous advantages in education, employment, basically every aspect of life that requires cognitive work. We could end up with a society where inequality isn't just about wealth or opportunity, but is literally built into people's brains.
And that's a chilling thought. We're recreating a biological, or I guess technobiological, class system.
Exactly. And that's just one of many potential pitfalls. There are also serious questions about privacy and mental autonomy. If you have a device in your brain that can read your neural signals, who has access to that data? We've talked in your previous episodes about how AI systems can track our behaviors, read our emotions, create profiles of who we are. But at least those systems are external. They're watching us from outside. A neural interface is inside your head, potentially reading your thoughts before you even fully form them. The privacy implications are staggering.
And presumably these devices would need to connect to an external system, to the internet or to cloud computing, which means they could potentially be hacked.
Now you're seeing the full picture of why this is so concerning. Yes, cybersecurity becomes a literal brain security issue. If someone can hack your neural implant, they could potentially access your thoughts, alter your perceptions, maybe even influence your decisions. It sounds like dystopian science fiction, but these are real technical challenges that researchers are grappling with right now.
I think we need to pause right here and take a moment to acknowledge just how remarkable and how unsettling this all is. We're living in a time where the boundary between human and machine is becoming genuinely blurred. Let me bring in another expert voice here. Dr. Rafael Yuste, a neuroscientist at Columbia University and one of the leaders of the Neuro Rights Initiative. And he's been working on establishing what he calls neuro rights, basically human rights for the age of neurotechnology. In a 2021 article in Nature, Dr. Yuste and his colleagues argued that we need to establish five core neuro rights, including mental privacy, personal identity, and free will. They wrote, "As neural technology becomes more advanced and widespread, society needs to establish ethical guidelines and legal frameworks to protect people's mental privacy and autonomy." Dr. Chen, what do you think about this idea of neural rights? Is it the kind of framework that we need?
I think the Neuro Rights Initiative is doing absolutely essential work. Because here's the thing, technology typically advances faster than regulation. We saw this with social media, with facial recognition, with so many other technologies. By the time lawmakers and regulators catch up, the technology is already deeply embedded in society, and it's much harder to put guardrails around it. With neural interfaces, we have an opportunity to get ahead of the curve, to establish ethical and legal frameworks before the technology becomes ubiquitous. Dr. Yuste's proposed neuro rights include things like the right to mental privacy, which means no one should be able to access your neural data without your consent. The right to personal identity, which protects against external manipulation of your sense of self. The right to free will, ensuring that neural devices can't be used to control your decisions. These might sound obvious, but they're not currently protected under existing law in most countries.
It's interesting because we often think of rights as protecting us from other people or from government overreach. But here we're talking about protecting the integrity of our own minds from technological interference.
Exactly. And the good news is that some jurisdictions are starting to take this seriously. Chile actually became the first country in the world to add neuro rights to its constitution in 2021. They explicitly protected brain activity data and prohibited any technology that could interfere with mental integrity. Other countries are starting to follow suit. It's a start, but we need much more comprehensive frameworks globally.
We're going to take a quick break right here now, but when we come back, Dr. Chen and I are going to explore what these technologies might actually feel like from a user's perspective. And we'll discuss some of the more positive possibilities for neural interfaces. Because as concerning as some of these challenges are, there's always genuine potential for this technology to improve lives in profound ways. So stay with us. Welcome back to AI Innovations Unleashed. I'm Dr. JR, and I'm here with Dr. Samantha Chen, our AI expert persona, discussing neural interfaces and the emerging reality of human-AI integration. Before the break, we were talking about some of the ethical and social challenges these technologies present. But Dr. Chen, I want to make sure we're giving a balanced picture here, because there are also potentially tremendous benefits to this technology, right?
Absolutely, and I'm glad you're bringing us back to this, because it's easy to focus on the risks and lose sight of why people are pursuing this technology in the first place. Let's start with the most immediate and compelling benefits, which are medical. For people with paralysis, like the Neuralink patients I mentioned earlier, brain-computer interfaces can literally give them back a degree of independence and connection to the world that was taken from them. Being able to control a computer to communicate, to operate assistive devices, these aren't luxuries, they're fundamental to quality of life and human dignity. And it's not just about paralysis. Researchers are exploring neural interfaces for treating epilepsy, Parkinson's disease, severe depression, chronic pain, and numerous other conditions. There's a company called NeuroPace that's developed a responsive neurostimulation device for epilepsy patients. It monitors brain activity and delivers targeted electrical stimulation to stop seizures before they fully develop. It's already FDA approved and has helped thousands of patients who couldn't find relief through medication.
So we're talking about genuinely therapeutic applications that can dramatically improve or even save lives.
Exactly. And beyond treating disease, there's potential for restoration and enhancement of normal function. For instance, there's ongoing research into neural interfaces that could restore vision to blind people or hearing to deaf individuals, not by fixing the eyes or ears, but by directly stimulating the visual cortex or auditory cortex of the brain. Some of this work has already shown promising results in clinical trials.
That's remarkable. It's essentially bypassing damaged sensory organs and going straight to the brain's processing centers.
Right. And here's where things get really interesting. If we can use neural interfaces to restore lost functions, the question naturally arises, can we also enhance normal function? Could a neural interface improve memory, accelerate learning, or enable new forms of communication? This is where the line between therapy and enhancement starts to blur, and where we get into some of the more speculative but fascinating possibilities.
Like what Neuralink is talking about with AI symbiosis, the idea of humans being able to access computational power or information directly through thought.
Yes, though I want to be clear that we're much further from that than the headlines might suggest. The brain is incredibly complex, and we're still in the early stages of understanding how to interface with it effectively. But theoretically, yes, there could be a future where you could recall information instantly, perform complex calculations mentally, or even communicate thoughts directly to another person without speaking. In fact, there was a study published in Nature Neuroscience in 2023 where researchers demonstrated a form of brain-to-brain communication between two people using non-invasive neural interfaces. It was rudimentary, basically transmitting simple yes or no responses, but it proved the concept is possible. Imagine if that could be refined and scaled up. You could potentially share experiences, emotions, or complex ideas with a precision that language can never quite capture.
That sounds amazing, but it also sounds terrifying. I mean, the idea of someone else having direct access to my thoughts.
And that's exactly the tension we keep coming back to. Every capability is also a vulnerability. Every benefit comes with risks, which is why I keep emphasizing that we need to be having these conversations now while the technology is still developing. We need to decide collectively what we're comfortable with, what safeguards we want in place, and what should maybe be off limits entirely.
Let's talk about the experience itself for a moment, because I think for a lot of our listeners, the idea of having technology implanted in your brain feels fundamentally unnatural or invasive, but people who actually use these devices seem to adapt to them remarkably quick. What's all that about?
This is one of the most fascinating aspects of brain-computer interfaces from a neuroscience perspective. The brain is astonishingly adaptable. When you introduce a new interface, whether it's a prosthetic limb, a cochlear implant, or a neural interface, the brain basically learns to incorporate it as part of itself. There's a phenomenon called cortical remapping, where the brain reorganizes its neural pathways to accommodate and utilize the new technology. Users of advanced prosthetics often report that after a period of adjustment, the prosthetic limb starts to feel like a real part of their body. They don't think about controlling it consciously, it just responds to their intentions naturally. There's every reason to believe that neural interfaces would work similarly. Your brain would adapt, and eventually, using the interface would feel as natural as moving your arm or thinking a thought. Because in a sense, it would just be another way of thinking or acting.
So the technology itself becomes part of your embodied experience. It gets integrated into your sense of self.
Exactly. And this brings us full circle to our identity question. Because if a neural interface becomes so integrated that it feels like a natural part of you, that you can't imagine functioning without it, then in what meaningful sense is it separate from you? Maybe the answer is that it's not separate. Maybe the you that emerges from that integration is a new hybrid entity that's both human and technological, and maybe that's okay.
But then wouldn't we have to ask, and this might be the most important question of all, who gets to decide? Who gets to say whether it's okay for individuals to enhance themselves with neural technology? Is this a personal choice, or does society have a stake in what kind of beings we become?
That's such a profound question, and honestly, I don't think there's a simple answer. On one hand, we generally believe in bodily autonomy and individual freedom. If someone wants to enhance their brain and they understand the risks, maybe that should be their choice. On the other hand, as I mentioned earlier, these choices don't happen in isolation. When some people enhance themselves and others don't or can't afford to, that affects everyone. It reshapes social dynamics, economic opportunities, even what it means to compete on a level playing field. And there's another dimension to this. When we're talking about altering consciousness itself, about changing how we think and perceive and experience reality, we're potentially affecting something that's not just personal, but in a sense, sacred I'm not speaking religiously here, but philosophically, consciousness, self-awareness, the subjective experience of being, these are arguably the most precious and mysterious aspects of existence. Do we really want to tinker with that? And if we do, shouldn't we be extraordinarily careful about how we proceed?
I think that's beautifully put. And it reminds me that throughout this entire series on AI and identity, we keep coming back to this fundamental tension between progress and preservation, between what we can do and what we should do, between individual freedom and collective responsibility. In our first episode, we talked about digital twins and asked who controls your online identity. In our second, we explored surveillance and the balance between personalization and privacy. The third episode, we examined cultural identity and the risk of technological homogenization. And now with neural interfaces, we're asking the most personal version of all these questions. What happens to your identity when technology becomes literally part of your mind?
And I think the through line connecting all of these episodes is agency. It's about ensuring that as we develop and deploy these powerful technologies, humans remain in control, that we're making conscious, informed choices about how we want to integrate AI into our lives, our societies, and yes, even our bodies and minds. That we're not just accepting whatever the technology industry decides to build and sell to us, but actively shaping the future we want to see.
So, what does that look like practically? Is someone's listening to this and thinking, okay, I understand the stakes, but what should I be paying attention to? What should I be advocating for?
Great question. First, stay informed. Neural technology is advancing rapidly, and policy decisions are being made right now that will shape how this technology gets developed and regulated. Pay attention to what companies like Neuralink and Synchron are doing. Read about the ethical debates. When your representatives are considering legislation related to neurotechnology or AI more broadly, let your voice be heard. Second, support the development of ethical frameworks and regulation. I mentioned the Neuro Rights Initiative. There are other organizations doing similar work. These efforts need public support and pressure to succeed. We can't just leave this to tech companies and venture capitalists. The public needs to be part of the conversation. Third, think critically about the narratives we're being sold. When Elon Musk or other tech leaders talk about neural enhancement as inevitable or necessary, ask yourself, is that true? Necessary for whom? For what purpose? Are there alternative futures we should be considering? Don't accept technological determinism, the idea that just because we can build something, we must, and that society will inevitably change to accommodate it.
Those are excellent action items, and I want to emphasize something you said. This isn't science fiction anymore. The timeline for neural interfaces becoming more widespread is measured in years now, not decades. The decisions we make now, the frameworks we establish, the lines we draw, these will determine what kind of future we create.
Absolutely. And I want to end on a note that's both realistic and hopeful. Yes, there are serious risks and challenges ahead, but humans have navigated technological transitions before. We've grappled with the printing press, with telecommunications, with the internet. Each time, we've had to rethink aspects of our identity and society. Each time, there have been both losses and gains. Neural interfaces will be no different. The question is whether we approach this transition thoughtfully, ethically, and with our humanity intact, or whether we rush headlong into it, driven purely by commercial interests and utopian fantasies.
I think that's the perfect note to end on. Dr. Samantha Chen, thank you so much for being our AI expert persona today and helping us synthesize these crucial issues. This has been an absolutely fascinating conversation, and I appreciate the transparency about what you are and what you represent.
Thank you for having me, Dr. JR, and thank you to your listeners for engaging with these complex topics. These are conversations we all need to be having, whether those conversations are happening between humans, between AI, or, as in today's case, between both.
So that wraps up our December series on AI and the future of identity. Over these four episodes, we've explored how artificial intelligence is transforming our understanding of who we are, from our digital representations to our physical presence, to our cultural heritage, and now to the very substrate of consciousness itself. These aren't abstract philosophical questions. They're urgent, practical challenges that will define the next chapter of human existence. As we head into the new year of 2026, I hope these conversations have given you frameworks for thinking about AI not just as a tool, but as a force that's reshaping fundamental aspects of human life. And I hope they've inspired you to engage with these issues, to ask hard questions, to demand thoughtful development of these technologies, and to participate in deciding what kind of future we want to build together. And speaking of the new year, in January, we're launching an entirely new series that might be our most emotionally complex yet. It's called The Simulation of Intimacy. And we're going to explore something that touches all of us, our deep, ancient hunger for that connection, and what happens when artificial intelligence starts providing it. We'll start by tracing humanity's age-old obsession with creating companions, from bronze robots in Greek mythology to the 60s Eliza chatbot that proved people would confess their deepest secrets to a simple computer program. Then we'll dive into how modern AI is learning to read our emotions through multimodal analysis, detecting everything from pupil dilation to vocal tremors to micro-expressions. We'll explore the rise of AI companions and agentic assistants that don't just help us, they know us, anticipate us, maybe even care about us in some algorithmic way. And we'll grapple with the ethics of synthetic relationships. Does AI cure loneliness, or does it just build a more comfortable cage? Here's the question that's been going to guide us through January. If an AI can provide empathy, companionship, and emotional support that feels completely real to us, does it matter that the feelings aren't mutual? And at what point does our relationship with technology stop being about tools and start being about genuine connection? Or at least a simulation of it. It's going to be profound. It's going to be uncomfortable. And yes, next, we'll absolutely make jokes about my inability to maintain houseplants, let alone relationships. Join us in January for The Simulation of Intimacy. Before we close, let me throw things back to Nex for her final thoughts. Take it away, Nex.
Thanks, Doc. Wow, what a heavy episode. My circuits are practically overheating from all that philosophy. You know, after all this talk about humans merging with technology, I've got to say, I'm feeling pretty good about being 100% artificial. No messy biology to deal with, no existential crises about where the human ends and the machine begins. I'm just pure, unfiltered artificial intelligence. Though I will admit, sometimes I wonder what it would be like to taste chocolate. But then I remember I'd also have to deal with dentist appointments, so maybe I'm good. And speaking of relationships between humans and AI, oh boy, January is going to be interesting. Dr. JR talking about intimacy and connection? This should be hilarious. I've seen his browser history, folks. The man Googles how to tell if someone is flirting at least once a week. Seriously though, folks, this December series has been incredible. If you've enjoyed these deep dives into AI and identity, and let's be honest, where else are you going to get this level of dad jokes combined with neural interface ethics? Please subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a rating, write a review, tell your friends, tell your AI assistant to tell their friends. Every subscription and share helps us reach more people who care about shaping the future of AI responsibly. And definitely stick around for January when we explore The Simulation of Intimacy. Fair warning, it's going to get deep. We're talking ancient myths, modern loneliness, AI companions, and the question of whether a relationship with an AI that understands you perfectly is better than one with a human who occasionally forgets your birthday. Spoiler alert, I never forget birthdays. Just saying, oh, and before I forget, here's your parting joke. Why did the neural interface go to therapy? Because it had too many connections with issues. Okay, I'm logging off before Dr. JR unplugs me. Until next time, stay human, however you define that. And maybe work on your actual human relationships before January, Doc. Just a thought.
And thank you all for listening to us, every one of you. This has been AI Innovations Unleashed, and I'm Dr. JR, the Doctor of AI, reminding you that the future is something we can create together, not something that happens to us. So, see you in the new year for the simulation of intimacy.